Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. 2 years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court did something it had never done before. Walk back a right it had already granted.
At the Supreme Court today, an historic upheaval. In a sweeping ruling that overturned a half a century of precedents, five justices ended the right of American women to choose abortion under the Constitution.
That's right. The Supreme Court has officially overturned Roe v. Wade.
The court overturned 50 years of legal precedent that day, saying it was a mistake to interpret our right to privacy as including a right to an abortion. The split decision upended abortion laws across the country, including right here in Ohio. For a few weeks, we had one of the most restrictive abortion laws in the country. The Heartbeat Bill banned almost all abortions after 6 weeks, which is when fetal cardiac activity is first detected, and it's often before a woman even knows that she's pregnant. Today, we have a constitutional amendment in Ohio that creates pathways to abortion that can go even beyond fetal viability.
Hot off the presses, our decision desk has just made a call in Ohio on issue one, and we project that it will pass. Yes, on issue one will pass, putting the right to abortion in the state constitution in Ohio.
I asked Ohio Right to Life President Mike Ganadakis whether he thinks the state is better or worse 2 years after the Dobbs decision.
I think we're status quo from an abortion access perspective. You know, look, abortion has always been legal in the state of Ohio. It's never been illegal. In Ohio, the closest we came, obviously, was with the Heartbeat Bill, but that was enjoined, and it's no longer the law in Ohio based on issue one. But there's always been access. You know, obviously, I'd like there not to be. I'd like for women to make choices to save lives. But the amount of clinics in Ohio today are the same over the past decade, at least. There was quite many more back in the 1980s. But over the past 10 years, the number of abortion clinics in Ohio has pretty much been status quo. So access is there, and the Dobbs decision didn't impact that, in my opinion.
I've been wondering about that a lot in terms of the national right to life movement, because in some ways, I don't know. I can't decide if you guys got what you wanted or if it's the cautionary tale of be careful what you wish for.
That's the million-dollar question, friend, and I think you hit the nail on the head. And I still, you know, even though it's been 2 years, as you said, you know, I still think, you know, that we need to let this decision mature and see where we end up. But, you know, here in Ohio or across the country, the Dobbs decision did not impact the access to abortion, and it did not make abortion illegal. It just said, hey, states, you know, do what you want. For lack of a better term, in layman's terms. So, you know, what the Supreme Court said is it's not a federal constitutional right, but from Ohio to Missouri to Indiana to Texas, you can decide as Ohioans what you want to do, either at the ballot box with a ballot initiative or through your elected representatives. And whatever you want to do is up to you as an individual state, states' rights, correct? And also, I think what you said moments ago, be careful what you wish for. You know, we're living that here in Ohio now and in a handful of other states where the pro-choice side has been successful at amending constitutions. But, you know, I think Ohio has always been somewhere in the middle. You know, I would love for it to be 100% pro-life, and I'm sure those in the pro-choice community would like it to be 100% pro-choice, but it's not. You know, even with issue one last year being successful, I don't believe a majority of Ohioans believe abortion is acceptable during the 8th, 9th month of pregnancy. I don't think they believe it's acceptable in the 7th or 8th month, maybe except to save a woman's life, of course. And I think most Ohioans, even pro-choice Ohioans, think late-term abortion is abhorrent. But based on the election results last year, I think, they want it to stay legal, but I think they would want it to see for it to be rare as well. And that's what Ohio Right to Life has continued to do. You know, ever since Dobbs, ever since issue one last year, we haven't stopped working and advocating. Now, our tactics have changed. Our strategies have changed, of course, based on last year's results. But, you know, we're finding tremendous success at the legislative and executive branch level, ensuring women have access to health care, prenatal care, diapers, car seats, cribs, formula, housing. You know, we're diving into the areas of tax credits for childcare now, too. So we're looking at that practical effect. That's our focus today.
Ganadakis says one of the weirder twists of the post-Dobbs world has been working with lawmakers he'd never really spoken to in the past. helping them pass bipartisan bills to expand access to maternal health care, even increase availability of child care.
A family or an individual making $30,000 a year cannot afford child care. Come on. I mean, you and I both know that. There's not a chance in heck anyone could afford child care. But what we need to be careful of is, and by the way, we do support increasing the poverty line, so more people, you know, because 50 is probably not enough. You know, $50,000 a year, how can you afford your bills and child care if you make $50,000? But here's where I'm going to challenge the child care industry, because it is, you know, in every industry, regardless, but we're talking about child care here, when more government money flows in the system, they just raise their prices. You know, it's one thing if something goes up 3-5% a year, cost of inflation, right? But I mean, the cost has just exploded. And I'm worrying that, like our university tuitions, if, you know, if a corporation just knows that there's government money behind it, they can just keep raising their prices. So I think we need to peel back a few layers, make sure there's not price gouging, make sure that this isn't just profit driven by owners and operators of child care companies. I think we would be better off. But at the end of the day, a single mom that needs access to child care doesn't care about what I just said. She needs access to child care, right? So the governor's on the right path. I think the legislature will be receptive.
Though he's learning that his socially conservative allies are also fiscal conservatives. And with revenues projected to decline in the coming year, it could get tougher to find the money for all the things he'd now like to fund. Ganadakis is also looking ahead to November. Ohio is going to elect 3 state Supreme Court judges. And these judges will decide whether our 24-hour waiting period for an abortion is legal. They could also decide whether laws like transfer agreements to hospitals, bans on abortion after Down syndrome diagnoses, bans on telemedicine for abortion, whether any of Ohio's abortion laws will stay legal in light of the constitutional amendment. And for Ganadakis, that's the whole ballgame.
There's no race more important in Ohio for the pro-life movement than this 3 Supreme Court races. And we're going to work tirelessly now and up until Election Day to get our candidates across the finish line, hopefully.
Is it more important to you than the U.S. Senate race?
Well, now look, they're all important from Doug Ketcher to President of the United States. I love them all. We care about them all. But, you know, from an impact of what does state issue one mean, there's only one body that can determine that. It's not President Trump or Biden. It's going to be the Ohio Supreme Court. So in that vein, what does issue one actually mean from a judicial perspective? The court races are the most important.
The Dobbs decision also brought divisions in the pro-life community to the forefront. Southern Baptists, the country's largest and most politically powerful Protestant denomination, voted earlier this month to oppose in vitro fertilization, or IVF. The non-binding resolution said IVF, quote, most often participates in the destruction of embryonic human life. It encourages their followers to use only the kinds of reproductive tech that affirms, quote, the unconditional value and right to life of every human being. Liam Adams is a religion reporter for The Tennessean with the USA Today Network. Adams covered that annual meeting of Southern Baptists, and he joins us now. Welcome to All Sides, Liam.
Thanks for having me.
The debate over IVF at this convention of Southern Baptists sounded emotional. Can you describe what it was like to be in the room?
Yeah, it was. I would say first it kind of caught a lot of us reporters by surprise because we had expected some other big issues to come up around women pastors and abuse reform at the SBC. And this one, the issue of IVF, there's a lot of division within the evangelical community over this issue. Pew Research Center report in May said 63% of white evangelical Protestants believe IVF is good and 28% were unsure. And so there was a lot of sort of questions about how this resolution would play out on the floor of the convention. And sort of in a play-by-play, what happened was there were some delegates who are called messengers that tried to amend the resolution to soften some of the language. And that led to a pretty emotional debate in which people were speaking both for and against IVF. And then there was a vote on the amendment, which failed pretty handedly. And then immediately after, there was another vote to approve the resolution in its original form, and that was overwhelmingly passed.
That sounds surprising, given what you just said, that the majority of Southern Baptists support IVF. Is it just the most religious among them are the ones going to this convention?
So really, I mean, this is the first time that the Southern Baptists have taken up this discussion in this format. There have been some sort of leading voices in the SBC who have long been opposed to IVF, and they were among those folks were those who authored and submitted this resolution. But this is really, you know, this resolution, even though it's a non-binding sort of statement of values, represents a turning point for the SBC and sort of evangelicalism more broadly. It's, you know, I mean, the way that we had put it was that this could help popularize an idea once considered fringe throughout American Christianity. You know, Catholics have long sort of had a position on IVF and surrogacy, and that has been sort of opposed to it, the Catholic Church. But there really hasn't been the kind of language or way of sort of articulating. Evangelicals haven't had a sort of solidified way of articulating their position on this issue. And this resolution is the first step toward that.
The president of the SBC's Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission said this to Politico. He said, "It took us 50 years to take down Roe. It may take a similarly long time frame to get people to a place where they're thinking more deeply about something like this. It's okay. It takes time. We have to be patient." I thought that was fascinating that he compared it to Roe v. Wade.
Yeah, so this is very much in line with the larger conversation within the SBC around abortion. And that's why one of the reasons why I wasn't surprised that the resolution ultimately passed, because this is the proponents of this resolution, the authors of this, including Al Mohler, the president of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, who's a leading evangelical voice, says that this is sort of in lockstep. This is consistent with Southern Baptists' anti-abortion views, and that this is in sort of line with Southern Baptist views that life begins at conception. And so I think that this will kind of take time to sort of percolate down onto the sort of ground level of the SBC. But you had referenced the comments from Brent Leatherwood, the president of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, which is based here in Nashville. And they're already lobbying and advocating to members of Congress to sort of limit funding and access to IVF. So I think we're going to see sort of a growing anti-IVF sentiment, or at least a sentiment among evangelicals to limit access to IVF.
Yeah, it's what's fascinating to me is, you know, the anti-abortion, the right to life community, when Roe was law of the land, they were unified essentially against a common enemy. They wanted to overturn Roe. They wanted to take away federal protections to abortion. But now that they've done that, this is sort of revealed, I don't know if fracture is the right word, but a disagreement amongst that community about what do we do with things like birth control? What do we do with things like IVF? I asked Ohio Right to Life President Mike Anadakis yesterday, and he said he didn't agree with the Southern Baptist vote. Now, he's not a Southern Baptist. And it wasn't that he wasn't concerned about what happens to unused fertilized embryos. He was, but he said he just wasn't willing to say that people shouldn't use IVF. And it's, you know, they were speaking, I don't know if that makes sense, but I feel like they were speaking all with one voice until Dobbs. And now they have all these different ideas about how restrictive of a country we should be.
Yeah, and I think that's very true that, you know, the position of the SBC through this resolution is not, I mean, at the same time, there was conversations in the Senate around IVF and access to IVF. And so there is division among conservatives about IVF. But when you think about Southern Baptists, who are sort of one of the most politically powerful sort of denominations in the anti-abortion movement, this is what they see as a next step. I mean, another big part is they are advocating very strongly and very actively for abortion restrictions at the state level. And so the overturning of Roe v. Wade was in some ways that the beginning of a new chapter. I mean, yes, for the whole anti-abortion movement, but specifically Southern Baptists. And I think you're going to see more of that with the on the IVF front as well.
Yeah, Ted Cruz is a Southern Baptist, and he sponsored the Senate's Protect IVF bill. So it puts him in a really interesting position where the leaders of his faith are saying one thing, but politically he's saying something different. Or at least for now. I don't know if Cruz will change his opinion on it.
Yeah, and I think that that's what's, sometimes with these resolutions at the SBC, it is part of an ongoing conversation within the denomination. I mean, the number of resolutions that they've approved over the years about abortion, I mean, it's too many to count. Same with about women in ministry. But this resolution, I mean, why, even again, though it's sort of non-binding, why it's so important is because it's really the Southern Baptist taking a step out ahead of sort of conventional conservative politics. And, I think you saw within, even though Southern Baptists overwhelmingly affirm this resolution, there's still a lot of confusion or Southern Baptists don't necessarily know how to articulate it. And so what the question is how is, for example, the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, which is the public policy arm of the SBC, how is it going to be communicating to sort of everyday Southern Baptists in the pews about how to think about IVF? How are their pastors going to be talking about it on, Sunday sermons? So that's what I'm going to be kind of looking out for, especially as we get closer to November, how much of an effect this is going to have, this particular issue.
That was Liam Adams, religion reporter for The Tennessean, part of the USA Today Network. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we're getting an abortion provider's take on Ohio 2 years post-Dobbs. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Dr. Catherine Romanos is an abortion provider here in Ohio. She's been in practice for 6 years, watching as Ohio added each new restriction, as the Supreme Court overturned federal protections for the procedure, as the heartbeat bill became law, and as Ohio voters added abortion protections into the state's constitution. She joins me now to talk about access to abortion here in Ohio. Dr. Romanos, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you for having me. And I've actually been practicing abortion in Ohio since 2013, so I've seen even more laws implemented than just the 6 years.
As a reproductive healthcare provider, on the day of the Dobbs decision, can you remind us what it was like that day?
I remember so vividly because I had COVID. I was quarantined on my back porch, and had already called into work. I couldn't go in and provide that day because I was sick. And so I felt incredibly helpless that everyone's world was getting turned upside down and I couldn't help. So I sent my partner out for some Sudafed and I got on press calls and tried to do what I could from my back porch. But I should say that we weren't surprised by Dobbs. We were disappointed, but we weren't surprised. We had been preparing for that day for many months and even longer, knowing that people who oppose abortion had been working towards that decision for a really long time.
And it had leaked And we weren't completely sure that it was the final decision, but it gave everybody at the very least a heads up.
Yeah, we started preparing in December when we heard the oral arguments. And then when the leak came out, we ramped up our efforts to start thinking about how we were going to get patients taken care of.
The heartbeat bill banning almost all abortion in Ohio went into effect almost immediately. Did your clinic have to call and cancel patients?
We did. It was chaos. It was really, really scary for us and for patients because primarily no one wants to break the law. We were all just trying to follow the law, patients and providers. And so we were trying to figure out where patients could go to get safe and legal care. And we were trying to figure out what we could do for our patients legally. And I so vividly remember more than one patient saying to me, I made my appointment last Monday. I don't understand why I'm not allowed to have my abortion today, this Monday. And all we could say was your rights were taken away over the weekend.
The law eventually goes on hold, and we sit in this legal gray limbo until November 2023, when Ohio voters decide to add abortion protections to the state constitution. But it actually hasn't changed much legally because the heartbeat bill is still a law in Ohio. It's just on permanent pause.
Yeah, and we're still waiting to hear from the courts about what will happen. We'll hear any day on that now. I would say that from the time that Dobbs came down to the time the amendment passed, we were all kind of living with an underlying level of anxiety about, you know, for myself and my coworkers, we were worried about our jobs. But for patients, we were worried about if they would be okay, where they would go, who was going to help them. And I think it was more than anything really confusing. It was confusing for patients to figure out what they needed to do to get their health care. And then it was even confusing for really well-meaning healthcare providers who wanted to help direct patients. But things were changing so rapidly that even the well-meaning pro-choice OBGYN in Upper Arlington couldn't quite keep up with where they could send patients and how they could help their patients.
It also appears to have been confusing for a lot of prominent Republicans. Here's Governor Mike DeWine the day he signed that heartbeat bill into law in 2019.
The essential function of government is to protect the most vulnerable among us, those who do not have a voice. Government's role should be to protect life from the beginning to the end, to protect those who cannot protect themselves, such as the elderly, the unborn, those who are sick, those who have a disability, those who have a mental illness or an addiction. The signing of this bill today is consistent with that respect for life and the imperative to protect those who cannot protect themselves.
And then here's the governor after the abortion amendment passed last November.
I think if there had been exceptions for rape and incest, as I asked for there to be, I don't know if we'd had a different outcome or not, but I think it would have given people a better choice. That is something that I will always feel.
What has it been like to watch Republicans move from no abortions at all, which the heartbeat bill did not contain exemptions for rape or incest, to supporting things like a 15-week national limit?
I think it gives me a little bit of whiplash. In the first statement that you played from Governor DeWine, he listed a number of really vulnerable populations, all of whom I care about deeply as a family doctor. The one population he didn't mention were pregnant people. He never talked about a person who is pregnant and in a vulnerable situation. And one could say that anyone who's pregnant is in a vulnerable situation, and he left them off that list. And so I didn't hear him add those people to his list of vulnerable populations that he wanted to protect. I can't speak to his political motives, but I would hope that he is learning that this is healthcare and you can't just strip it away without horrible, horrible life-threatening consequences.
We heard from Ohio Right to Life President Mike Gonadakis earlier in this hour, but I want to ask you the same question I asked him. Do you think those who oppose abortion have experienced the cautionary cliche, be careful what you wish for?
No, I don't know. I'm a doctor, right? I'm a doctor. And I care about this a lot, but I am not in the business of interpreting political fights.
Does it ever frustrate you then that it gets so political?
Yes, I'm a doctor. I shouldn't know what a circuit court en banc opinion means, right? Like there are things that I have had to learn in my career as an abortion provider that are not medicine. And have they gotten what they asked for? I don't know. My patients haven't gotten what they asked for. You know, even before Dobbs, abortion was really, really hard to access in Ohio and in many other states. And it hasn't changed much since the amendment. And we have a lot of work left to do to make this very basic healthcare accessible.
Yeah, a lawsuit has also been filed here in Ohio to remove the 24-hour mandatory waiting period for abortions. And you are a plaintiff in that lawsuit, so we won't dive into the details. But I want to ask a more general question about how much confusion all of these laws, all of these court decisions, all of these amendments have had for your patients.
It's so heartbreaking. It's so, so heartbreaking. I would say that several times a month, I have someone, you know, I'll go through the whole process with them, ultrasounds, lab work, counseling, and we'll sign an informed consent. And at the end of the visit to try and make an appointment for their abortion, they'll lean in and they'll say, is this legal? And I'll say, yes, of course this is legal. I'm a board certified doctor. I want to provide you with safe, legal care. And even coming to a clinic with a real doctor, they're concerned that they're doing something wrong and illegal. It's notable in that story that they're willing to do it. You know, a lot of people just feel desperate to access this healthcare.
Abortion medication is something that we've been hearing a lot about in recent weeks. You know, the majority of abortions are now performed via these medications, 63%, according to the Guttmacher Institute. And the Supreme Court unanimously rejected a lawsuit that would have likely taken the drug off the market. But there is an asterisk on that decision, is that it didn't actually protect access. It was a technical ruling about standing. So I have to imagine you and other providers are concerned that another lawsuit is going to come and actually make the substantive challenge.
Absolutely. I think that the people who oppose abortion have proved that their beliefs will drive them to do just about anything to strip rights away from pregnant people. And so it was explained to me that in the writings about this mifepristone case, there were hints given about how one might bring a similar case back and not get caught up on that standing piece, which concerns me a little bit about the impartiality of the justices on the Supreme Court. But yes, I'm concerned that the case will come back and I'm concerned that it will just provide more confusion for my patients.
Now, one of the realities of the Dobbs world is that it's very different from the one where Jane Roe couldn't get an abortion. Abortion medication didn't exist. Now it does. The internet exists. You can have telemedicine appointments. It's a little sketchy, but there are people who have ordered abortion pills from online pharmacies. It is a totally different universe post-Dobbs than it was before Roe.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up because I think for a long time, people used the coat hanger as a symbol of an illegal abortion to prove that illegal abortions were unsafe. And it's a hard knot to untangle for a lot of healthcare providers that now there are some illegal abortions happening in states where abortion is not legal, and maybe in states where abortion is legal, that are safe, right? If you can order abortion pills online, we actually have pretty good evidence, excellent evidence, that taking those pills on your own at home with the support of a hotline or a doula or the internet is a very safe option for you. So it's a bit of a twist to get people to see that illegal abortion is not necessarily unsafe now that we have pills.
Yeah. The state of Ohio, though, still bans telemedicine and abortion. And it's
absolutely.
And it debated this issue of whether you could stop or reverse it by not taking the second pill. As a doctor, that's got to be so confusing to sit and listen to all these lawmakers talk science.
It was incredibly frustrating because there were some really bad studies that were done on abortion reversal. And laws were based on those few bad studies that were either retracted or not endorsed by major medical associations. And a really great study was done in California to prove that abortion reversal was not only not possible, but it was actually very dangerous. And even with that really good data, it's been hard to convince state legislators that abortion reversal is harmful.
There was a state lawmaker a couple of years ago who pontificated about the possibility of taking an ectopic pregnancy and transplanting it into the uterus, which is also not medically possible.
No, that's not possible.
I'm sure a lot of women with ectopic pregnancies might wish it were possible.
Yes. We're not there yet. Who knows? But no, that is not possible.
And do you ever have to combat any of that misinformation or confusion in your practice? Do you have people who ask these kinds of questions?
Every day, yes. There's a lot of misinformation just out there. There is also a large network of crisis pregnancy centers who are targeting pregnant people with the scariest misinformation they can find. So a lot of times when someone without a lot of resources finds themselves pregnant, they go to a crisis pregnancy center or one of these places you might see advertised that offers free pregnancy tests and ultrasounds. And once they're there, they often are told a lot of really scary things. And so if I see a patient who's been to a place for a free ultrasound and pregnancy test, I'll often ask, did they say anything to you that scared you or that you wanted to ask or verify with me? And frequently they'll say, well, they told me I would never be able to have children again. Is that true? They told me I'd get breast cancer. Is that true? They told me I'd become suicidal. Is that true? And I say, no, and we go through the list of things that are not just misinformation floating around out there, that are misinformation that are being propagated very intentionally to pregnant people.
I'm going to ask you one final question, and it's going to be somewhat political, so I apologize. But how important are the state Supreme Court races this November to the future of abortion access in Ohio?
I ask everyone I know to make sure they're registered to vote, to please remember to vote. We encourage our patients to register to vote. A lot of the cases that we're talking about in Ohio will end up before the state Supreme Court, and our current state Supreme Court is very anti-choice. So that is an incredibly important election. However, it doesn't matter what happens at our state Supreme Court if we elect a Republican president and a Republican House and Senate that have promised a national abortion ban, because a national abortion ban would trump anything that our state Supreme Court does or anything that was passed in our constitutional amendment. So yes, it's important, but it's not the only important thing this November.
This has been Dr. Catherine Romanos. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, what do Ohioans need to know about the history of abortion law, and what should they keep in mind for the future? That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Today we're talking about reproductive rights 2 years after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. And joining us now is Jessie Hill. She's a law professor and director of the Reproductive Rights Law Initiative at Case Western University. Welcome back to All Sides, Jessie.
Thank you for having me.
Since the Dobbs decision took effect, 28 states have passed laws protecting the right to have an abortion, 7 states allow it with limiting factors, and 14 have pretty much banned the procedure outright. So it's kind of a mixed bag in the United States now.
Absolutely. I mean, this was a fairly predictable result of Dobbs that we would end up with this patchwork where, you know, essentially where you live dictates what kinds of rights you have to access medical treatment and make pregnancy-related decisions.
And, you know, in Ohio, what I found really fascinating is at the beginning of the hour, we spoke with Mike Gunadakis, and he said that when it comes to abortion in Ohio, he feels like it's exactly where it was before the Dobbs decision. Do you think, in terms of access, it's exactly where we were before Dobbs?
Well, I guess that's actually a fairly accurate statement in terms of the current state of affairs right now is that, you know, post issue one, although issue one actually created a very broad right to abortion and other reproductive health care that, you know, in theory should allow abortion to be even more accessible than it was before the Dobbs ruling and before issue one, actually, you know, a lot of legal barriers still stand in place. So, yeah, I think that that's an accurate characterization. It's pretty much, you know, the pre-Dobbs status quo right now in Ohio.
I want to get a quick update from you on where all the different laws stand, because I think this is something that we even heard about just in the last segment with the doctor, that people don't really know what's legal and what's not because it's all tangled up in the courts. So the heartbeat bill, which banned pretty much all abortions, that is still a law. It's just on permanent pause.
That's right. And the state of Ohio, the Attorney General Dave Yost has taken the position that that law is also agrees that that law is unconstitutional after issue one. So we don't expect that to really be an issue or to go into effect, but there is some sort of wrangling over the technicalities of what kind of order the court is going to issue in that case, basically. So the case is not over, believe it or not. It is still dragging on, but the ban is, I think it's fair to say, not coming back.
Yeah, it hasn't even got to the state Supreme Court yet.
Right. And so, I mean, I you know, like I said, I feel some fair amount of confidence that, you know, it, given that even the Attorney General agrees that this law can't be enforced, I don't think we're going to be facing a ban again anytime like the six-week ban or the so-called heartbeat ban. But you know, there is kind of you might say a lot of taxpayer resources being expended right now in a lawsuit to fight over, like I said, very technical issues that, you know, we hope can just get resolved without massive appeals and all of that.
Then there's the 24-hour waiting period. So if you tell a provider that you would like an abortion, they make you wait 24 hours and come back before you can have one. That is in the very early stages of being challenged.
That's right. So a lawsuit was filed challenging that at the end of March. There is a hearing scheduled in August right now on a request for blocking that law. And that would be a temporary order that blocks the law while the remainder of the litigation plays out. So we'll have to see. So for right now, that law's in effect. And that's a really good example of how a restriction that has been in place for many decades and was in place before Dobbs really is now unconstitutional under the new amendment. But nothing has changed yet because the state has basically said, look, if you want any of these other than the heartbeat ban, if you want any of these laws to be blocked, you're going to have to sue us. And so there are just going to be lawsuits and lawsuits and lawsuits challenging these restrictions as time goes on.
The state legislature could come in and take these laws out, but it is a Republican-controlled state legislature. It is a Republican governor. And Mike DeWine has said that he wouldn't support taking these out. They want to let the courts do this.
That's right. And that's what you're describing actually more or less happened in Michigan after Michigan passed a reproductive freedom amendment to their constitution in November of 2022. The legislature ultimately did pass a law repealing a bunch of abortion restrictions. And that is, really the best way to go. It's much cleaner. It takes those things just off the books permanently. Whereas instead, this is requiring, as I just alluded to, expenditure of resources on all sides, including taxpayer money that is being used to defend these laws, and a protracted legal battle that in the end may result in a court order saying these laws are unconstitutional, but the laws actually also still remain on the books and could be enforced again in the future if anything were to change. So it's not ideal, but it's the only path we have right now.
When it comes to some of the other abortion laws, because there are dozens, it like every General Assembly up until the Dobbs decision passed some kind of abortion restriction. So there is a law that bans abortion after the diagnosis of Down syndrome. There are laws about what doctors have to say regarding whether abortion pills can be reversible. There are laws about transfer agreements, which means you have to have admitting privileges in hospitals. None of those have been challenged as of yet.
Right. Well, some of them have actually the one about written transfer
Oh,
agreements
okay.
with hospitals is the subject of a lawsuit currently. But yeah, it's a resource-intensive process. It takes time, but I think the key is that what Ohioans voted for with respect to issue one was the idea that reproductive health care decisions are private medical decisions that should be between individuals and their physicians and their healthcare providers and not for the government to weigh in on. And so, I think it should be fairly clear that all of those laws are, their days are numbered. That's my view.
One of the laws that the opposition to issue one in November really hammered home was the idea that this amendment could end parental consent for abortion. And I want to be clear, there has been no legal challenge to the parental consent in Ohio, and it sounds like that's not really on the radar of a lot of groups.
I mean, I can't speak for all the groups or
Right.
what may or may not happen or like express, legal strategy plans
Give us a
either.
definitive answer for all time. No.
But that's correct. It has not, been challenged. I am unaware of any, challenge that is currently in the works.
And even though abortion, is a medical issue, a moral issue, a family issue, it is also very much a political issue. We've been talking this whole hour about the importance of the state Supreme Court races, because ultimately, Ohio's state Supreme Court is going to determine what is legal and not legal under this constitution. But, the federal government is also talking about a national ban on abortion, maybe a 15-week ban. The Bernie Moreno, the Republican running for U.S. Senate, has said he would support such a thing. And ultimately, that could trump our laws here in the state of Ohio.
That's exactly right, because federal law is supreme according to our US Constitution over state law. So if a federal ban were to pass, that it wouldn't matter what Ohio's constitution says or what Ohio's laws say or California's or New York's or anyone's for that matter. So what you have outlined, I think, really just points to the incredible significance of this election in November of 2024. So both federally, because depending on what happens with the composition of the Senate and the House, as well as the presidency, you know, things could go one way or the other, and that would affect Ohio, as well as there's a very important Ohio Supreme Court race, which you just alluded to, will impact how all of these lawsuits that have been brought, that will be brought, how those are going to play out in the future.
U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown had a press call earlier this week, and he really highlighted the fact that the constitutional amendment that Ohioans passed last year, Issue 1, had wide support from voters in urban areas, in rural areas, that counties you would never think of as being open to Democratic ideas, like Butler County. I think Issue 1 passed narrowly in Butler County. And that's fascinating to me.
Yeah, it really is interesting. I think it shows that abortion is not a partisan issue. It has really broad support. Abortion rights are incredibly popular. And really, what that says to me is that the way our legislature has been gerrymandered and the way that the sort of extreme Republican legislators have approached the issue is really not representative even of their own constituencies, right? It just shows how far off base the rhetoric and the legislation that's been coming out of our General Assembly is in, you know, how far from public opinion that rhetoric and that legislation has gone. Because, and I think that is a direct result of the legislature not being representative because of the ability to gerrymander, which is also, by the way, something that's going to be on the ballot in November of 2024, whether we can, you know, the redistricting process and trying to reform that. So they're all very interrelated.
Lots of things to vote on in November. Senator Brown does say that he intends to make abortion a focal point in this tough reelection campaign.
My opponent, Bernie Moreno, wants to go to Washington overruled him. He contributed $100,000 to try to beat Issue 1 on the ballot. He says he's 100% pro-life with no exceptions. He wants a national abortion ban, no exception. He makes it clear he's looking out for his interests, not the interests of Ohio women.
I think that's an interesting tack to take. I mean, it makes sense that he's trying to win over voters in some of these more traditionally red areas. And he's saying, hey, if you voted for Issue 1, maybe you should also vote for me.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's an important political issue. And the really interesting thing is it seems to have only gained importance and salience since Dobbs rather than losing it. I think as the stories pile up about, you know, horrific trauma that women and couples and pregnant people have had to go through since Dobbs, the stories just pile up and people are really seeing the costs of these kinds of policies. It's real in a way it never was before. And I also just think it really speaks to this kind of, libertarian maybe instinct around keeping the government out of our private lives, right? And that's something that shares wider support across the political spectrum than maybe folks realized before Dobbs.
I want to ask you about IVF, because it's back in the news, not just because of the Alabama Supreme Court ruling and all the back and forth that happened there, but the Southern Baptist Convention came out in opposition. And there's been a lot of political takes that, is this the moment that the religious right, is this the moment that evangelicals start a campaign against IVF? And I wonder, what is your take on it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's a real, so I don't, you know, I can't speak to what they will or will not do.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
But I think it's a real difficulty for the folks who are kind of absolutists on the anti-abortion side, because if they want to take the position that life begins at conception, they cannot coherently explain supporting IVF. So in a way, this position that the Southern Baptist Convention took is really the only coherent, logically consistent position. And they just haven't had, but it's a deeply unpopular one politically. I imagine it will remain so. And I think they're going to have a very hard time moving public opinion on that. And I think this is a tension that didn't have to be resolved when Roe v. Wade was in place, right? Because people had access to both. And now you know, the sort of contradictions are really really evident.
So, as far as the future of abortion, and we're getting down to like the final minute that we have together. So, August, we may get a preliminary injunction. We may press pause on the 24-hour waiting period, but that's really the next big legal moment.
As of right now, yeah. I mean, things are very fluid. Litigation timing tends to be very unpredictable. So we could get a final ruling in the 6-week ban case before then. We could see some of there's other litigation pending that was actually in place before Dobbs that has now raised new claims under the amendment. So we could see things happen in those cases as well. So I would just say definitely stay tuned.
We live in interesting times.
Yes.
That has been Jesse Hill, a professor of law at Case Western Reserve University Law School. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
And thank you all for listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.